Hello and welcome, everyone. My name is Arzu Mohsini, and I'm absolutely delighted introducing tonight's program with Suzanne Stevens, Thomas Kligerman, and Joel Barkley. We're here to celebrate the publication of Ike, Kligerman, Barkley Houses with a discussion and book signing. The discussion focuses on the impact of information age on the process and product of the firm, well known for its engagement with the traditional canon of architectural history and vividly referential domestic architecture. Joel Barkley is an architect and watercolorist who brings a painterly approach to the composition of houses and gardens. An organic gardener and beekeeper, Joel has illustrated several gardening books. He's also the co-owner of Broadway East, a terrific restaurant in the Lower East Side. Architect Thomas Kligerman creates a harmonious balance between building and environment through his integrated approach to landscape, architecture, and interiors. He has a formidable taste for traditional and modern styles of architecture, and his portfolio includes private residences throughout the United States and abroad. Suzanne Stevens is a deputy editor at Architectural Record and has been an architecture critic, professor, and writer for several decades. Her writing has appeared in many publications, including Progressive Architecture, Vanity Fair, Architectural Digest, and the New York Times. She was the lead author for Imagining Ground Zero, published in 2004. I'd like to thank our guests, who are seated on the front row, for appearing on this program, marking the sixth event in the new series, Architectural Explorations in Books, delving into the critical role that architecture publications play in the understanding of contemporary urban developments and structures. Copies of Ike, Kligerman, Barkley Houses are available for purchase and signing right after the Q&A session at the end of tonight's program. Also, I'd like to bring to your attention the art collection at Mid-Manhattan Library across Fifth Avenue from here, where you can freely and serendipitously browse a circulating collection of 40,000 books and videos covering every aspect of art, architecture, and design from all time periods in all five continents. Thank you all for your attendance, and now it's time to turn the floor to Suzanne Stevens.
Thank you. Good evening. I'm just going to make a few comments to, in a sense, frame our presentation tonight before we go into the discussion, and also explain in some why I am interested in the work of Ike, Kligerman, and Barkley, and where they where I first encountered them and where they seem to have been going. Whoops. I think I turned something on, I'm sorry, but we can live with this. So, when John Ike and Tom Kligerman opened their office in 1988, they were arriving in architecture at a particularly interesting moment. The previous two decades had seen the questioning of modernism, especially the commercialized version, and the embrace of history, spearheaded by the landmark book Rob Venturi's Complexity and Contradiction of 1966. It led to the postmodernist reaction to modernist architecture, and by the time Ike and Kligerman showed up on the scene, postmodernism had reached its efflorescence. The three principles Barkley joined in 1999, the three principles had been properly steeped in architectural history at the various universities in which they studied for their graduate architecture degrees: Columbia, John Ike; Yale, Tom Kligerman; and Princeton, Joel Barkley. All served time in the office of Robert A.M. Stern, who wrote the foreword for the book. And then they finally went on their own. They chose to build on their veneration of history in their practice, even though the signals of change were afoot. The rise of deconstructivist architecture, e.g., the Museum of Modern Art's deconstructivist show of 1988, and with it and neo-modernism challenged and soon replaced postmodernism, and with it, an engagement with history. The computer and its zoomy forms had taken over. Affinities to Sir Edwin Lutyens, C.F. Wasey, Harry T. Lindeberg, Stanford White, Bernard Maybeck, and others did not seem to be part of this landscape. But as you will see from the presentations and the discussion following, Ike, Clickerman, Barclay have done much to make their practice innovative while keeping their historical interests in focus. Before we explore the actual topics and why they are doing what they're doing, I want to turn it over to Tom Clickerman and then Joel Barclay, who will make their presentations. Thank you.
Thank you, Suzanne. Good evening. I'd like to thank the New York Public Library for inviting me and Joel Barclay to speak tonight. It's an honor to be in this incredible Beaux-Arts building and speaking under the auspices of an institution as important as the New York Public Library. And before I go any further, I just want to point out that John Ike is actually here also. He won't be speaking unless we drag him up. He's here in this in his leisure suit today. When we founded our office about 20 years ago, we wrestled with the question of style. We thought about developing or finding a look that would serve us and be recognizably Ike, Clickerman, and Barclay. So many of the greats of architecture have one that is clear the second you see it. But ultimately, we decided that there were simply too many aspects of architectural history that we wanted to explore. The three partners, John, Joel, and I, were all educated, as Suzanne says, at a time when there was an enormous resurgence of architectural history and the study of it, and our minds were filled with images from the past. There were simply too many things out there to focus on to really limit ourselves to simply one. So we decided that the same reason that makes people praise, for example, actors, a range of skills, it was something that you could also apply to architecture and design. So we have a diverse range of work. We try to find an architectural language that we can work with that appropriately expresses the dreams of our residential clients and the public face of our institutional clients. So in starting a project, we look to three things: the client's wishes and their programs, the architectural and cultural context of the new building, and also sort of a healthy dash of what we happen to be interested in at a given time. So with this in mind, I'd like to take you through a number of projects to show you how this all plays out in the work we do. And the first house, well, actually what I'd like to do is we're sort of group them into four types of architecture. Shingle style being one. We want to show you, I think, two houses that are in tropical locations, some modern work. And by the way, these are slides are all done for people who can read. That's why we put that word modern in there. We know we're in the library. And traditional houses. And I want to point out that these watercolors were all done by Joel Barclay, and they're sort of part of the process we go through when we design our houses. The first house is on the shore of New Jersey. It's a mixture of English cottage style and the shinglish style. We've sort of coined the term shinglish to describe it. But it's this dark green house that's wrapped in these cedar shingles that have been stained dark green. Here you can see a detail. The form's very simplified. That triangle over the window, the wavy green pattern of the drunken weave shingles on the roof. And even in the treatment of the brick, it's very simplified, spare, trimmed down so that it just wraps these volumes and expresses the forms without too much elaboration. Inside, however, going a little bit more traditional, moldings like around the ceiling there and the wainscot, but still taking the notion of the shingles and bringing them inside and wrapping the entrance hall with these smaller fish scale shingles. At the back of the property, overlooking this elliptical pool, is this little pool house, which is basically a baby version of the other house. It has all the elements of the main building, the steep pitched roof, the big brick piers, and the lack of detail. So sort of a miniature version of what's been happening up front. And I have to say, when John Ike and I were working on this, and John actually came up with the concept of the dark green, and I said, I was just terrified to actually put this thing on a property in the suburban landscape. And that was confirmed when all the kids in the neighborhood started calling it the Dracula house. And then Tim Burton put it in a movie, and, you know, I knew we were in trouble. This house is on the low-lying dunes of Martha's Vineyard. It's much more traditional, also shingle style. And we look to more traditional elements like this piece here, which has this bowed roof, which is part of the 18th century traditions of Martha's Vineyard, where boats, people who built boats built these houses. And although that appears once, we pick it up in the curve of these dormers. And in things like the chimneys, you can see in the front of the house here, a slight curve. But a much more traditional approach to, on the outward anyway, to the shingle style. But the house has been carved into with things like this breezeway painted white, or this porch, which allows light to reflect and come inside. And the whole house is kept very thin. So the inside, although you have all the elements of a traditional beach house with the weathered floors and the whitewashed ceilings and this whitewashed brick, it really is a relatively modern house with these bright rooms that are painted white and windows like this and this 12-foot-high ceiling of the living room, triple-hung windows forming this sort of glass and wood curtain wall, a very sort of spare treatment of an otherwise traditional type of building. But you don't always want to be in these great white rooms, so we have a series of rooms of contrast, like this little reading room, which is wrapped in cork, just wide enough for a sofa and a place to grab a book and catch your feet on fire. This little staircase that goes from the library up to the master bedroom, where you find the small sort of wooden room picked up in this shower in the master bedroom, where the it's all done in teak, almost like a little bento box. Suzanne wanted me to put a little personal spin on some of this. This is just a little aside. When we built the house, the husband came to me and said, look, we're going to put a secret room in this house. We're not going to tell the wife about it. She loves surfing. And so we inserted this room in the house. She had no idea it was going to be there. The only way you can find it is by knowing that one of the moldings opens and there's a button behind it. You press it, and absolutely silently, the ceiling comes down and a staircase comes out, and you walk up in here, and you hang around with your surfing coach or something. But what the husband didn't realize at the same time is we had sort of done some tricks on him, and when you open this panel here, the whole room becomes a sort of 60s psychedelic room, and we have Beach Boy albums and Led Zeppelin and stuff like that going on. Elsewhere on the property, this is the pool house, where we took the same forms of the shingle house, of the sort of the traditional cape, and instead made it a modern building, a glass and steel building enclosed in louvers, horizontal louvers of teak. But the house has the exact same proportions and roof pitch as the main house. Here you can see the light streaming through the louvers across the horizontal paneling in the little kitchen part of the building. And this is a view. Your back is to what we just saw. You're looking out to the water. And what really was sort of the driving inspiration for this building was the horizontal nature of the ocean and the horizon. And that was the reason for these great louvers. This is actually the 14th house we've done for this client. They've been fantastic clients. 4,000 miles away, another client. This is actually the third house we've done for them. They're not quite as fantastic as the other ones, but they're great clients nonetheless. Is this house coming with its own sort of host of requirements. It's in a development where the requirements are from the road, the house has to look like a Mexican village or have the elements of a Mexican village. Hence the sort of metal balconies, the pitched roofs, the timber, and the massing of the entrance like here where everything's broken up into little sort of pavilions and buildings. But you look through to the ocean, and you walk in, and when you come around to the ocean side, a different inspiration, and that is the southern architecture from the 1920s and 30s, Southern California architecture of architects like Wallace Neff, a big sweeping curve, big huge windows. Wallace Neff actually didn't do big windows, but we've added that with glass that pockets into the walls. So a completely different look, this very sort of modern negative edge pool that spills water over towards the beach, the fire pit sitting in the water in the foreground. But as you can see from this photograph, rather than Mexican village, it's sort of split between the traditional on the front and this much more modern thing, things like this beam here that owes a debt to Luis Barragan. Inside, like the house in the vineyard, very open. You walk in high. Here you drop down into the living room. Behind us is our big doors that open out to the beach and that pool I showed you. But the house, very open, stealing light not only from the beach side, but also here down the stairwell from the inland side. And a view from the kitchen back into that great room, no doors, just a nice sort of comfortable freeway of flowing in this vacation house. This is a client has very rough. Their main house is in Aspen, and this is their vacation house in Cabo. I don't feel very sorry for them. The private room is obviously the bedroom. It's not part of that free open plan, the master bedroom here. And I show this slide just to sort of indicate the size of these pocketing doors. This door is 10 and a half feet tall and 8 feet wide, and it completely disappears into the wall so that when you're in the house, it's almost like you're outside. And not only air comes, but also light. Behind us, a similar door opens onto your own little private patio where you have your own little spa, kind of a mini version of the pool, your own fireplace. Light filtered from above, and here a bigger version of that on the ocean side of the main house for the family and guests. This house is in Connecticut, and it sits at the top of a hill. It's in Wilton, Connecticut, but it's so high up that you can see all the way to Long Island. You can see boats on Long Island Sound. So in a way, it, like the other two, is on the water, even though it's 25 miles away. It's a renovation. When we got there, all that was on the site was this pyramid house, which we completely gutted. It looked like something out of a Charlie's Angels episode, sort of the worst of the 1970s. And our task was not only to renovate it, but to also put this addition on. And at first we thought, well, we should just do a little baby pyramid next to it, but it looked a little like, a duck with a baby following it. So instead we sort of looked at the horizontal nature of this pyramid and instead pulled this wing out. It goes east, almost like a sort of, wood passenger train that's flowing out towards the eastern side of the state across this plinth of stone, which is Connecticut fieldstone and granite. And although it's a modern house, it really has its roots in traditional buildings. And here you can see a base, a piano nobile up here. And this sort of, I don't know if you can see it because it's a little bit bright, the slide is dark, but this sort of flat roof that comes out made out of reclaimed Douglas fir that really is, it sort of harkens back to the cornice on a more traditional building. And inside, we brightened this otherwise. This room was pitch black before, smaller windows. Everything was painted black. The floor was brown tile. We lightened it with French limestone, new lighting, cleaned up the wood, opened it up. And so it really becomes a pyramid volume in which rooms sort of float like this study here, the dining room below, and this curved wall which surrounds a stair that goes down to the lower level. They actually jump out of that room into this pool, apparently, amazingly. They're partiers. Between the old part of the house and the new addition is this glass bridge, which is sort of an architectural synapse that links old to new. Glass not only on the floor but also on the walls on both sides, the windows, and in the distance is the master bedroom that you see here. And although this is not a pyramid like the other, like the old part of the house, it's a sort of a box. The idea is still the same, taken from the older part of the house, a big volume in which things like this walnut cube, which is actually the dressing room, floats, and it separates the bathroom behind from the bedroom on this side of the volume. This is a view. Our back is to the tennis court down the slope of the hill. On the right is the addition, the flat roof. In the distance, you see the pyramid of the old building, and then this sort of stone stair cascading down, sort of echoing the water flowing over the pool. You can see on the left or maybe the other way around, but everything sort of flowing down the hillside. We've been sort of spoiled, and most of the houses we do on the water on very broad sites, so that the house, every room in the house looks out towards the ocean. I just hit a button. I don't know what it's done. In this case, though, although the property is 850 feet deep, it's only about 135 feet wide where the house is, and so the trick became to find a style of architecture that could be squeezed onto a narrow site. And luckily for us, the client had this love for Cistercian abbeys in France and England, and even more luckily, they happened to mostly be in ruins. So here you see a fragment of a Cistercian building in England, which we took as our sort of cue, sort of the idea of a fragment of a building. Here you see the house itself. Our back is to Long Island Sound. This is in Greenwich. And you can see how we've borrowed the sort of arch forms from that ruin. But the thing about the house is the notion is, in our imaginations, this was once part of a much longer house of stone that someone had come along in later years and chopped off. So almost like a loaf of French bread, it's been sliced out. Here you see the white inside of the bread with sort of stony crust running down this side here facing the water. And this side here, which is the inland side, you come down the driveway, you go through that courtyard into the house beyond under this sort of gigantic slate roof. Spent a lot of time thinking about materials. The stone is Connecticut fieldstone. It's been surrounded by very sort of tightly milled limestone from Pennsylvania in these quoins and columns. And inside, the same sort of attention to materials in this ceiling, which is reclaimed oak with panels of elm in between them, and how they're all attached. You can see these steel sort of balusters come through, pierce the floor, and reappear underneath these beams that were taken out of an old barn in Connecticut. But this house, I guess like the others I've showed you, is very open. This room is 70 feet long. It expands across the whole house. Library behind us, living room, family room in the distance. Here's the kitchen, open. These doors here, these archways, rather, open to the dining room. And on the left, you can see into the entrance hall. The only two doors on the first floor go to the two powder rooms. Other than that, this is sort of a loft masquerading as a suburban house. There's just a view of the dining room through this arch ceiling, out the big glass window bay, into this courtyard. And all clients have a way of torturing you with some harebrained idea. In this case, the guy wanted a giant koi pond in the front yard. So this was the solution, this sort of New England version of an Asian garden with these giant 18-foot-long slabs of bluestone that sort of meander across the water. There are no railings. It's like this in the winter. It's just an ice bath. And somehow nobody, the water doesn't freeze, but everything else does. And somehow I think no one's fallen in, but it's really, we've sort of upped our insurance, let's put it that way. This house is by Andrea Palladio. It's one of the first houses he did, maybe the first villa, for Count Trissino, his great patron. And we took this as inspiration for a house on the shore in New Jersey. And here is the house. Like that Palladio house, the two towers that span between, piece of building spanning between. Like Palladio, it's on a very flat site. There's water. This happens to be the Atlantic Ocean on the other side, not the River Brenta. But this, in our mind's eye, was sort of a house that at one time was more like a bridge with this outdoor space you can see underneath. And at some point, someone came along, happened to also be us, and enclosed this great room. A sort of traditional room of wood and plaster with a stainless steel and glass curtain wall so that you have this sort of indoor-outdoor room, which even more than the other houses I've shown, really sort of take in light and air. People flow through this house. This is a house where the owner has sort of the personality of what we imagine Count Trissino was like, sort of larger than life, loves parties, 300 people show up with 15 minutes notice, but they can flow in and out just the way the air and light does. In the towers, smaller scaled rooms like this little sitting room, a view out towards the ocean you can see there, a little bit more wood, a little bit warmer in feeling, but a modern approach to detailing, just like this stair here in steel and timber, a sort of modern reinterpretation of a Greek meander. From the ocean side, the swimming pool, no one really goes in the Atlantic. It's getting more and more dangerous to get in the ocean these days. So this is, in a way, the ocean. And you can see the roof is in blue tile. The windows are trimmed in blue to pick up on the notion of sky and water. That's John Ike's dog, Missy, in the foreground. And lastly, we don't just do houses. I just wanted to show you this house, this building. This is a health, sort of a spa and a health center on the Biltmore Estate in North Carolina, that estate with the huge house that was built for the Vanderbilts in the 1880s. And they wanted something much more modern. We were trying to, you know, do something like Biltmore, but they wanted something like this. So local materials. The idea was that it would be rooted in the location because of the materials. So a modern kind of version of what you find at the Biltmore House, which has wood pergolas, very traditionally detailed. Here they're in steel, painted two different colors. You can see the local stone. You enter the building down the pergola. You turn left into the building. And the building, I don't know if you notice, has these two roofs that go like this. And that forms this joint here. It's a green building. The water runs down these roofs and is collected into cisterns for use in the mechanical systems. Indoors is sort of modern version of the great room in an old traditional house with the stone and the wood used for all kinds of functions. There's a teaching kitchen, and it's really almost like a community building. And just a glimpse outside through the curtain wall to the North Carolina mountain forest. And now I turn this over to Joel Barkley. Thank you. your time. Anyway.
A steep, wet, rocky site in Greenwich, Connecticut, combined with a family quickly growing in number, were both challenge and inspiration for this house. We call this one Svenglish, a conflation of the shingle and Swedish vernacular styles. Our adventurous young clients took to the idea of the black walls with white windows that we'd seen in a Swedish barn. The main portion of the house is of painted shingles, while the living room wing to the right is a vertically emphatic board and batten. Greenwich is quite reasonable with their building height limits, so we were able to make a roof slope that really reaches upward. We also convinced our clients to invert the color scheme at the motor court entry, which makes a stucco-lined outer room with a light welcoming embrace. Our detailing inside and out is plain. The living room cornice, made of boards, was inspired by one that we'd found in Linnaeus' house in Sweden, and then upstairs we just kept on using boards for everything. I see that Michael Graves is not in the audience, and I'm glad he's not, because in school he humanely insisted on us knowing exactly where the front door was, with no cleverness or ambiguity about its location. Here, the front door is actually the back door and is a part of the garden front with its deep, long stone living terrace. It's a vestigial front door that is seldom, if ever, used as a primary entry. It holds a special symbolic place, however, as a friendly Dutch door for the family to feel a connection to the living terrace and lawn from the center hall, with its fireplace shown here. Cars are how people actually arrive at the house, and in the white zone of the motor court, the area below a second-story bridge lures one in toward a timber-framed view. A monumental stone landscape stair up to the highest levels of the Tamed Hill might make you miss the entry, which is hidden off to the left and not visible in this photograph. Beneath all of this was a desire to tie inside and outside together in a unique way. Next, on the western shore of the island of Maui near Lahaina, is this tropical house. Its design combines three different things. First, the client wished for a house in the traditional wooden Hawaiian plantation style with porches and a Balinese roof. Second, his wife wished for a house in the Mediterranean style with arches and stucco walls. Third, we, the architects, wished for a house in the green and green style, thinking craftsman architecture in the Pasadena vein might feel very good there. As a large, luxurious bungalow, we thought we could arrive at a fruitful synthesis of the client's contradictory material and detailing wishes. The plan of the house is a split level. We wanted to have all the rooms feel close to each other and to never have to climb a full flight of steps. We very carefully worked out the entry sequence to the house to guard the fact that the main level was raised 6 feet above grade. We did this by having double or triple steps at frequent intervals in the forecourt, as well as inside the entry, and then up into the living room. That allowed us to have a main level with a raised lawn beyond, both of which have a clear view of the Pacific and the islands of Molokai and Lanai that they couldn't have otherwise had. We used several wood species in the house: teak, western red cedar, aphromosia, and here in the bar, we use koa, an indigenous wood. We tried to make this space feel as if it had been part of a porch that had been enclosed. The master bedroom, with its bamboo balustrade, is at the highest level. It gives a vertical element to the ocean facade and allows for the best views of pool, beach, and ocean. Below the master bedroom, behind a thermal window in the base of this wing, is a low exercise room several feet lower than the surface of the swimming pool. Afternoon or evening sunsets, that is, interact with the pool surface at waist level to mesmerizing effect. The house is approximately 8,000 square feet, but it really doesn't feel like a big house at all because of all the many levels. Going into the modern, this is a floor of a former butter warehouse in Tribeca. We were charged with turning it into a loft for a young family. Maybe the heavy, unreinforced concrete, a foot thick, straining the wood framing of the building, had been useful in keeping the butter cold, but it kept us from having another foot of ceiling height. Ceiling height was important to us, as the space is very broad and horizontal in proportion. We took out most of the concrete, but we left a bit, as you can see here in the foreground, near the entry. We didn't want to have to readjust the elevator, and we liked the effect of a raised entry, kind of like in a sitcom. The next problem wasn't as heavy. It was a light problem. In fact, we had a problem with light. How to get light into the center of a space that is 80 feet long with windows only at either end. Our strategy for this was to employ planes of materials both in plan and elevation. For example, this dynamic Mondrian-like screen wall for concealing storage and the kitchen is a shifting assembly of changing compositions. We didn't make rooms in the loft. In fact, we fought off the 16-foot column grid by having things not conform. Here in the living room is a gray rug with zippers at the column grid that allows the seating group to overtake one of the cast iron columns. The materials for the loft were bamboo, white painted sheetrock, honeycomb translucent panels, felt, and the comforting gray flannel that the husband had known on Wall Street. Going into the traditional style again, this clifftop villa on the Atlantic Ocean was inspired by John Nash's Sandridge Park. Its tripartite massing of slab to the left, cube in the center, and cylinder to the right is unified by a stucco finish and repetitive arched windows. The gray slate roof reveals the classicism through the lens of an English revivalist architect. Inside, an oak entry hall links the stairs and hallways of all three floors. There's a romantic Venetian bridge that leads to the master suite. And then on the other side is a little seat with a wooden screen for the children's hall opposite. The warmth of the space was a priority. It is the only area not overlooking the ocean, and we wanted to give it a comforting, centered character with warmth. The fireplace helped with that. Through the arches is the dining room, part of the open formal rooms that look out to the water. These areas flow together with their cool Venetian terrazzo floors. We used wood trim very minimally in these rooms to keep them light, but we made this English Gothic plasterwork of tiny vaults all around. Its lightness is due to its material, which is plaster. The largest room in the house is actually the master bathroom, which is sort of an unusual condition. You can see in this picture that it has access to its own sun deck overlooking the water, and it has a very high dome ceiling. The same form from the exterior shows the cylinder has a projecting limestone porch, allowing the sun deck that I just mentioned. It also provides cover for part of the big limestone terrace that spans the rear of the house. The detailing here is stark, simple, and we tried to manner our proportions in a way that Nash might have done. Next, this farmhouse in Louisa, Virginia, near Charlottesville, overlooks Green Springs Historic District. Our 1,000-acre component of what is a preserved 19th-century agricultural landscape neighbors the ruins of A.J. Davis's Hawkwood, a villa in what he described as the Tuscan style. Our farm was part of Hawkwood originally, but the land was severed from it by Highway 15 at some point during the 20th century. We designed for the site what people there call a manor house, which sounds very formal and Palladian. But we gave our house an informal, farmhouse-like bearing, with its non-hierarchical assemblage of simplified Greek Revival forms, all rendered in white. A welcoming acropolis rife with stray dogs, cats, horses, and all the critters of a working farm. The bigger parts of the house are white stucco, while the smaller portions at the edges are done in white clabbered. We also were liberal with our use of brick-floored porches because weather watching atop this high hill toward the Blue Ridge Mountains is an important part of daily life. While different in style from Davis's design across the highway, we felt the same picturesque tendencies of contrast, opposition, and balance would work well here. The house is approachable and modest, but in places has the appropriate formality. Here you can see the formal entry hall. We're often asked if this is an alteration to an existing house, which it is not, and we're pretty sure that's a compliment, but you never know. The 28-horse stable with its rigidly symmetrical form has an exaggerated center peak housing farm staff. Its form was borrowed from a stable by Harry T. Lindeberg from the 1920s. I'm going to show you two non-residential projects that are currently on our minds. The first we optimistically show is a project still on the boards for a beach club along Florida's Gulf Coast in a panhandle town near Seaside called Alice Beach. A new urbanist conception by Duane Plater-Zyberg, Alice Beach's monochromatic, restrained white townscape is to have our building at the water's edge. The stark Antiguan island vocabulary led us to this mirage of a building, its form a large wave emanating from the pure white sand into a cresting, lilting Beaux-Arts facade. Riding the top of the wave is a lounge that looks down to a dining terrace, then to the pool, then to the beach, and then to the ocean in stepped levels. The Italian colonia or beach resort of the last century comes to mind here. It's almost like a cruise ship that's been run aground. A dining room occupies the airy, high-ceilinged piano nobile, and the monolithic ground floor is mostly spa, changing, and pool functions. The concavity of the front elevation's porthole top, a Nordic as well as a nautical reference, hints at the breaking of the Beaux-Arts civic and social anchor into relaxed, dressed down, and undressed leisure. We think the building will be exceptionally fun and have high hopes for its execution. The last building here is the home for Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research in the heart of Stanford University's campus. It is a 35,000 square foot conference and office building where scholars from other disciplines converge to address economic issues from diverse perspectives. In the shadow of the Hoover Tower, we designed an L with the building's wings forming a courtyard containing orange trees and a hypostyle of palms. A long linear fountain under a pergola defines a third wall along the main street. The conference rooms and social spaces break out into this outdoor room, capitalizing on Stanford's remarkably perfect climate. The wing reaching out to the street has a limestone arched panel and some picturesque stair apertures. The inspiration for this street front was the pre-1906 earthquake memorial arch, which collapsed, leaving Stanford's main axis of Palm Drive more open and less monumental. We toned down the monumentality of our facade a little bit through scale and detailing, but we have made a very confident, bold entrance. We showed this drawing in one of our first presentations, in fact, in the first presentation to the Institute's board, and the building stayed remarkably true to this early image. The details show our admiration for some of the neighboring Bakewell and Brown buildings on campus, as well as the amazing original Richardsonian Romanesque features of Olmsted's quads. The piers and arches of stone leave a lot of glass area, making the interiors lively and sunny, facilitating both the solitary and social undertakings fostered by the Institute. Finally, the great view from atop our entry arch to the mountains. Anyone can come up this stair, and it's a great place to go for no reason. I think from the wide variety of images that Tom and I have shown and described, you can see how context, client input, and a deep obsessive engagement with architectural history can take us into wildly diverse directions with each project. Thank you for letting us show our work.
I think we'll go up to the why don't I sit in the middle? And I think first what I want to do is ask Tom, what was it about history when you came into the practice? It was 1988. Everybody's talking about the Museum of Modern Art deconstructivist show. You had already been out of school, but you had to make some choices. So what was it?
I didn't know about the exhibit, to tell you the truth. I guess I have always loved historical architecture. I majored in architecture at Columbia, and there's a huge emphasis, or there was at the time, on architectural history. And in fact, I had enough architectural history credit through the art department that I really could have had a double major. So I guess the term is no-brainer. It just was what I felt adept at, what I loved.
And you felt that you could absorb enough architectural history and research it and make a practice out of it without looking In those days, people looked very eclectic, and often the buildings looked undercooked or...
You know, that was one of the frustrating things about postmodernism that you described earlier, is it always looked like a cartoon. It was sort of unsatisfying. At first, it seemed like a great thing. It was a great alternative to all the sort of glass boxes that were being built through the 50s, 60s, 70s. But after a while, it just seemed unsatisfying. It really never really quite got there. And I think maybe the proof of that is when you see that some of those buildings, I mean, they look sort of fun, that they look like cartoons. And they don't hold up well.
So you decided you were going to be serious, and after working in Stern's office, even more serious. And
yeah. And I guess I didn't know I was that serious. But, yeah, I think we decided, as I said earlier, that we really wanted to look at architecture. I mean, we have this, I'll show in a few minutes, sort of a pretty big library for us, not as big as this library, of books that we use all the time, and it's sort of fun, and you know, you can get lost in these things, and so that's something it's just sort of in our blood, I guess, we love to do it.
Okay, and Joel, you've joined the firm in 1999, but you had also been at SOM, which does commercial structures, large commercial office buildings, and you'd been at Diller and Scavidio, which in those days was especially known for unbuilt avant-garde work.
I was trying to learn everything. Between the firms do very divergent types of work, but what I found between the Bob Stern's office and the other two you mentioned is that architecture is architecture, and if it's well done, the genre isn't that important because we're all architecting. Architecting is sort of a way of life and a way of solving problems, whether it's design problems or just the way you spend your day.
But what did you see about Diller and Scafidio's work that was going to help you in future life?
The work I did at Diller and Scafidio was actually performance art. And a lot of lessons I learned there were about the importance of installations. We do installations with, for example, interior. We have an interiors project in department in the office. And Diller and Scafidio has gone on to do buildings, but when I was there, we didn't do buildings at all. We did museum installations. And it really taught me how to work against a deadline, a hard deadline, not missing your goal, being timely. But truly, as architects, they have more in common with someone like Bob Stern or Bruce Graham than they have in terms of difference. We're all committed and passionate about what we do.
Okay, good. Now, in terms of this book, you've gathered your work together at a time when a lot of architects are just doing websites. And I've been hearing from several publishers that they're finding that monographs of their work, of architects' work, seem to be less in demand by a public because they can actually just go to the web. So why did you want to do a book?
My mom doesn't surf the internet.
That's a good answer.
is that good enough?
I think that's fine, unless you have something to add to that.
That's fine. Well, I mean...
No, he's got something to say.
I do?
Okay.
Oh.
Yes, you do.
Okay, I do. I think there is still something about a book that... there's a lot of intangibles. It's something you can kind of get lost in. It's something that you learn more about other things as you go through it than what you necessarily have gone there to find. And it's also an edited piece of history that's, you know, someone who supposedly knows what they're doing has put together and thought about versus the sort of wild world of the web that you click on and kind of anything goes. So I think the book is still important. Although I have to say we do have a website and we are looking into other ways to sort of promote ourselves and show what we do through electronic media like Facebook and Twitter and things like that. So we aren't blind to it, but I think there's room for both.
And you're also switching, or it seems to me, moving from houses to institutional work or wanting to get there.
Doing both.
What about the scale difference? I mean, there, everybody has always gotten hung up on that. Often people say that the best work of most modern architects have been their small houses. You know, Breuer, you could say that. You could say that with Richard Meier. You could say that with Corbusier.
Charlie Guathmey.
We've experienced a bit of that. We showed the Stanford building. It is different working with an institutional client in terms of how much you can lavish attention on lots of details, because you know people on their own care a lot more about infinite details than a board, you know, a building committee. And however, we were very lucky in that building to really get a lot more into the detailing than most institutional buildings.
But I'd say generally it's just a bigger house. I mean, I know there are differences that Joel described, but it's always frustrating to us that someone comes and wants a townhouse, and because we've only done one townhouse, they don't hire us. You know, there's different parameters. It's all design. It's almost like buying a house. Seems like a daunting task at first, but it's one step at a time. So
it is often hard to turn that corner. How did you convince Stanford to let you do something that large?
We had a very rich client who sort of insisted on it.
And you had done the house, or the house for the client?
We're doing a series of buildings for them.
Good way to get in there.
Sort of the old-fashioned way.
We're in there, but we're not looking to move. We love houses.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's good.
When you say we're moving or shifting, I'm not sure how true that is.
Okay.
Our hearts are in houses.
Yeah, I mean, I think all the buildings we're doing that are not houses have come through our residential clients one way or another. So that's been the way we've been able to bridge that, because it is difficult to break into it.
And considering that this is a digital age, you are using the computer now. And you, if we could go to the PowerPoint, you're going to show us some things you said to me earlier about how you do this.
Stand over here so I can see what I'm talking about.
Okay.
This is a two quick views of our office where we actually have a real library. We have about 3,500 books. You can see them scattered around. We also have computers. But this is really where we go, if it's not in our mind's eye, to do research when we start projects. So the world that Joel and John and I fancy we live in is this one, with sort of the leather-bound volumes, the watercolors, a glass of Merlot. But it is true, when you go to a book, like this book on English architecture here, if you want to find a room in, say, a church by Sir Christopher Wren, You end up looking through the book and you see other things he's done. You see other English buildings. It's really part of a continuum. It's part of an edited piece of history. And so this is really important to us, and we try to get people in our office to use the library. But our reality is different from today's reality, which looks more like this. This is someone's in the office desk, who remains nameless, happens to be in the audience tonight. In this world, if you're lucky, you get two computer screens. Not everybody has that, but you look across your sort of mouse and your iPod and your water bottle, and while you're maybe working on the house in South Carolina with a model here, you also have your Facebook page open to make sure your friends know what you're doing every second. And then when you say, can you look up this building by Sir Edwin Lutyens, this is what you find. A sort of smattering of portraits, chimney details, an office block, and a model of Sir Lutyens's head on a pedestal. So, you know, if you don't know anything about architectural history to begin with, it's very hard to draw from that correct conclusions. If you're really smart, I guess you can't, but difficult, even if you know something about it. I just want to take you very quickly through what's happened in the 20 years since we started our practice. This is that house I showed you with the pyramid before we began. And every house, whether it's on computer or hand-drawn, starts with something like this. This is our first idea with this sort of upside-down pyramid. Turned out to be way too expensive. But whether you're working in the digital medium or not, we like to start with a sketch or a concept. This house I showed earlier, the house in Deal, New Jersey, all hand-drawn. This elevation you can see here, this is a drawing that's entirely done by hand. All these marks, everything, you can sort of see the expressive nature of hand-drawing here. This is actually a blueprint. It doesn't exist anymore. Now everything goes sort of through the air and the Ethernet, or you have a Xerox machine. So blueprints don't exist anymore. Here's a drawing, just I want to show quickly, of a cabinet in the dining room. And you can see that sort of a hand is at work almost. You can see the architect's eye at work here. And here's that cabinet in sort of a dark image in the house. The next thing that happened was you started drafting, but you drafted in the computer. And the only difference really was that instead of having a pencil and paper, you were drawing on the computer. So all those lines are drawn by you. You're just drawn in the computer. These words are actually typed into the computer. And although it looks very kind of stiff and everything, this is the house in the vineyard. And this is what it actually looks like. So there's really a leap you have to make, more of a leap, I think, from that hard drawing to this than you make from hand drawing to the final product. Even though things are drawn on a computer, we continue to do things by hand. This is done by Alex Eng in our office at the front of the house in the vineyard. You can see the breezeway and the front door on the left. Here it is, the breezeway and front door. So ways to show the client as you move along what the house is going to look like. Hard to do that in a lot of the computer renderings. This rendering of Joel's of the house in Maui, this was done about 2 years before the house was done, sort of a fancier drawing for what ended up looking like this. But things have taken a big step forward, and this is a house, this is a photograph of a house under construction. It was taken about 4 days ago. It's in the mountains of South Carolina, and this house was drawn in a new program, which is one of sort of many that's out there now. This is called Revit, where instead of drawing in the computer, you're actually building the house in the computer. It's not an easy thing to do. You have to have a spatial sense. You have to have an understanding of how things are put together, and drawings that come out might look something like this. That's the same house. You've seen it from the air in this view. And it's helpful because the owner can now kind of look at this sort of flat model, understand things. But it's great for the builder, too, because you can take this thing, and because it's really a model, it's not just a drawing, you can chop it open. And there you see a section through the living room, and you see the bedroom above it. You chop it again. There's the elevator, and you see the kitchen. Doors out to the screen porch. You want to see more, you chop it again. And you can chop it any place, and you can look at the corner of the back of the building if you want. That wouldn't stand up, but it's kind of a cool idea for something. And the other thing that's happened is models actually come out of the computer. This is a model of the house in on the shore in Cabo San Lucas. This is actually a three-dimensional print. It's actually a three-dimensional Xerox. And you send the drawing off to the model maker. I think he's like in, you know, Afghanistan. I don't know where he is. And he has a machine that, and layer by layer, this little house grows. And it's great as a working model. It's very inexpensive. It's very fast. You can show your clients. But you still have to kind of make that leap in your mind to what ultimately looks like this. This is the same house on the ocean side. So amazing tools. And I want to show you one last thing, and then I'll let Suzanne take over again. Mm-hmm. The other thing that you can do with these new programs, and these are relatively simple. Bigger firms like Skidmore, Owings & Merrill have much more elaborate things where the buildings look real. This is a new house we're doing at Martha's Vineyard. This is a model which we use not only for ourselves, but to design the house. You come in, you go under this sort of breezeway, the front door is ahead of you, the main house there on the left, and there's a screen porch that connects across to the sort of guest house here, guest house and garage building. But an amazing way to, not only for us to look at something, but to also show a client. This house will start construction in about 4 months, but in a way you've almost seen it already. And this is, again, really simple. You can do much more elaborate things that look almost 100% real. And you can go inside, you can see the inside is done. Model's not about the inside. But unimaginable 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, something like this. So that's sort of what's happened in the design process, and it has good and bad things about it. So.
Okay, so now in terms of the creative process, you do a lot of watercolors and sketches and all that. Do you do them the way Stephen Hull does them, where you start at the beginning with a watercolor and sort of develop a concept for the building that way? Or
I think you're asking if we use watercolor as
creative
production or reproduction.
Well,
representation.
Yes. Get there or presentation to the client.
Right. Yeah. Well, with modern work, I was very influenced by Stephen Hull when I was in school, both at Georgia Tech and at Princeton. And I also love the work of Zaha Hadid. And I would do paintings, more abstract types of work, also, you know, applicable to 20th century modernism, but I would use paintings as a developmental tool. You know, layering of watercolor can determine a floor plan, for example. With modern or minimal work, that's very appropriate. In lots of this, in the traditional work that we do, it's more of an impressionistic approach. What I love about doing a figurative picture of, what I love about figurative pictures of houses is, you can also almost be impressionistic about them. In the client's eye, they hold together, but you don't have to commit to all the materials yet. It's sort of an embryonic thing which has the appearance of completion without being totally finished. So I would say no, that compositionally the medium doesn't impact a lot of the work we do now as much as it could if we were dealing in a more abstract sense. Mm-hmm. There are too many external factors and references probably to be sort of in the Stephen Hole direction. But I think what I love about our diversity of work is we do modern things and traditional things, so we can sort of dip into both.
Mm-hmm. And also, I noticed, of course, and I think it's very obvious when you look at the book, you have done so much exploration of different craft techniques and different kinds of materials. How do you do? You know, how do you find all the materials, and how do you, you know, what do you do as your research in the office to uncover all of that?
We look, and we travel a lot. You know, books are our primary vehicle of research, but Tom, you probably are better.
I don't know. I think it's amazing. People always say, "Oh, look at this building, for example. Look at that building; could never be built today." And the truth is, this building could be built today. It would be outrageously expensive, but there's nothing in this building that the craftsmen don't exist to do. It all can be done, and I think. One of the things, I guess it was a frustration of postmodernism, was it sort of there was sort of a pastiche of an idea about history. The buildings I think we do are, we really kind of get into the details. We almost put ourselves in the mindset of the architect at the time who was doing these buildings, whether it was Maybeck or Lutyens or someone like that. So I think that's what makes the difference between sort of this sort of superficial thing and the people are out there to do it. If you look at those details and study them, you can find the tile, you can find the glass guy, you can find the guy who does the bronze work. It all exists as long as there's someone willing to pay for it. And we have been very lucky that we found some of those people. We're looking for more, if you know any.
But you found one person willing to do 14.
Yeah, we want another one like that.
So that's... okay, so where is architecture going today, really? Is it getting away, you know, you say about the sketch and about Revit. Revit gives you an idea, the animation, and Revit gives you an idea of how a building looks in model and how it looks as you move around it spatially, but it doesn't give you a feeling, really, of the material at all. And so you can use both the hand technique and the computer technique, which I think you're doing. For
yes.
Creative work as well as for just following it through production. But where do you think, when you look at the architecture landscape, where do you think everything's going right now?
I think it's sort of splitting. I think there's people, I guess, like us who are squares. And what we think is sort of modern and cool like that, I guess that little pool house is really not that modern nowadays. I get the journal from Yale University School of Architecture, and it's just sort of amazing to see what people are doing. And I know this isn't true. But it almost seems like the computer is actually doing the work now. Clients say to us, well, just have the computer draw it up. And well, the computer doesn't really draw it up. But I get the sense when I look at these things that that's what's happening, that by creating kind of a grid that you can then distort on the computer, that's ending up being the design of the house. So I think I don't know where it's taking us. It's led to some pretty cool things. But
well, another problem.
There's that's that on the one hand and very traditional things on the other hand. Well, I guess, clients can change things whenever they want, but at least if they see that, they're changing when it's electrons and not when it's steel and wood. So, it's better. They see it up front. They really do see it better.
But one of the problems I have with technology where it is right now is a lot of clients really want the immediacy of buying a car. Mm. Because when you see some of these animations, it's almost like going to an automobile website and seeing cars spinning around and pushing a button and they turn red or black or blue. And houses still aren't, well, I guess except for prefabricated houses, aren't quite there, especially the ones we do. They're much harder and much longer to kind of come about.
And what about the economic climate, too? I mean, we're in a recession. We're still not out of it. A lot of businesses are still tanking. People look on the future and say that we may dip again, if you call that the last one a dip. Does that make you nervous?
Well, we showed projects of all different sizes and budgets. I mean, some of these were really big, some of them not so big, to use that phrase. But the not so big thing, I think, is something we're very supportive of, is doing less house, but still lavishing a lot of thought onto it.
Yeah, I guess I agree. I mean, I think it has been a slow period. Our phone didn't ring for 18 months. Part of that's because no one uses the phone anymore. They email you, but it was still a scary time. It was very quiet around the office. I agree with Joel. I think I'm optimistic, but I think we always try and get clients to do smaller things anyway. I think that's the direction. Believe it or not, that we sort of push towards smaller and better rather than big and sort of cheap.
And do you think more interest in history will come back? You know, because right now, as everybody's been so fascinated with the computer and the kind of a futuristic.
I don't know. We could probably ask people in the audience who got out of school more recently. It's it is a little, frankly, frustrating to me that you mention things that just sort of sail over people's heads. I hope it comes back. You know, one of the good things about technology is our library is in much better condition than it ever was before because no one goes in there, opens a book. So I think it's going to last for a while because I've always been worried about all these broken spines.
Yeah. Cut out pages.
Yeah, don't even. But I hope it comes back. I hope people start looking at that again.
Okay, well, so right now we should probably go to the audience and see if anybody has any questions. Wendy Moonen.
The one on the water in Greenwich with the courtyard with a little garden in the front is on the market for $35 million if you're interested.
Is that the one?
The fish go with them. No, and actually the house that's on the cover of the book has been sold twice.
Mm. It's so special like that, I wondered if
I'm not sure. Maybe because the house is so special it's not selling, but it might be the price too. I don't know. You know.
We don't hear the word retail very often. I mean, resale value. It's not usually part of the conversation.
I saw a hand back there. Sir? Did you raise your hand? Okay, somebody right there?
Worry because of worry that that we've missed the boat, that somehow technology is spinning ahead of us and we got our heads in the sand. A little bit. I do sometimes when I get these magazines from Yale and I see the stuff that's in Architectural Record and things like that, I sort of think we're just old fogies. And so, you know, but we are trying to balance technology. You know, there are a lot of people who do the kinds of houses we do that have rejected Revit because it is very difficult to work with, particularly in houses that are complicated like ours. But we're trying to embrace it. And
there were firms, too, that rejected AutoCAD.
Yeah. So. Our former employer prided himself for quite a while, Robert Stern, on not drawing things in the computer. That's completely changed. But in the early years, he would sort of make that one of his selling points to clients. We draw everything by hand.
But he doesn't.
He doesn't draw.
Yeah.
No, he draws by hand. He sketches by hand.
John Eich, thinks it's important that we stay current. And he's always behind us keeping up with what's going on.
You didn't show anything in blob.
Anything what?
No, blob art.
Blob.
No.
B-L-O-B.
What does that mean?
Okay, sir.
The modern loft I showed has been turned into a bordello. It's terrible, but it's a loft, and it's been sold twice.
Is that because of the decorator coming in, or
the owner just not being sympathetic with the style? It was a pretty minimal environment, and I can imagine all sorts of reasons why. You know, there were a lot of translucent planes and things that didn't afford total privacy. A space like that is a very individual kind of thing, and if there's too much flow and open space, it could be a problem.
Actually, we've had the opportunity to go back, and I guess more houses have sold than I realized. I just saw another one in St. Louis that we did, and someone bought it, and we were never happy with the interiors. And the new people who bought it hired us to do a renovation of it, and we were able to go back and kind of and fix what we had done and kind of make it the way we had originally intended it to be, which was an amazing thing to do.
You have an interiors department. And do you get to do all your interiors for the houses, or do people kind of say, well, I have my own person?
We do both. Some people come with an interior designer. I'd say we do about 50 to 60% of the interiors, and we're happy to work with other people. It's sort of, you know, you learn new things. It's sort of like that pond in front of that house in Greenwich. It's all that kind of stuff that your clients ask you to do or another interior designer asks you to do that you wouldn't do on your own that really starts off just being, you know, the most frustrating thing. Often ends up being the most powerful thing in the building. So we work with both, ours and others, and we enjoy it. Okay. Welcome it.
Does anybody else? Woody McIntosh.
We've been engaged. We've sat on juries at universities recently, but what you're saying is a very important point. There are certain schools that embrace traditionalism and actually kind of reinforce classicism, like Notre Dame, and that's a source I know at Bob Stern's office for a lot of people. We love Notre Dame people, but we tend to hire across the board, you know, from all regions, all types of schools. But it is harder for us to probably attract people right out of school than firms that maybe do work that's consistently more avant-garde or more cutting edge. Would you agree?
Yeah, when we sometimes go to hiring fairs and we have our little, you know, house on Martha's Vineyard and the person next to you has some sort of glow-in-the-dark thing, and that is what people are attracted to these days as students, I think. There are enough, fortunately, who are interested in working on what we do. But
Yale tries to do a both end kind of thing.
I think Bob Stern has done an amazing job at Yale of being inclusive. There was a lot of fear when he went there that he would create this sort of postmodern, only history kind of school. He's actually embraced everything, and I think probably made it certainly one of the best schools of architecture in the country or the world. It's just, it's amazing the transformation for that openness.
But Princeton has no place for me anymore. Well, it's just such a doggedly dogmatic avant-garde environment. When you look at the lecture series, and it was that way when I was there, and I actually benefited from it and enjoyed the program immensely. But it's what we do, we've strayed pretty far in the other direction. And I don't get asked for as many critiques as I used to, just to be honest.
Are there any other? I see one hand. Okay.
I've been wondering for both of you, you're both obviously very passionate about what you do. And I was wondering, back in childhood, at what point did you realize that architecture was your passion? And was it a person or a structure?
My parents, we lived in New Haven, Connecticut, and my parents sent me to the Child Development Center at the university, which is part of the psychology department, psychiatry department, where they observe kids. And I was three, and they called my parents in for this evaluation because they worried I was very limited because all I would do was build block buildings. So I guess that's when I would build them, I'd have my friends go inside then kick them over. I'm not sure where the murderer part comes in, but maybe they'll show up. But I guess when I really realized I wanted to be an architect was seventh grade. I was at a little private school, and we could design your own courses, and I designed a course on designing houses. So seventh grade, when I thought I wanted to be that, wasn't until I was a senior in high school I realized I really could be that. I thought I had to be a lawyer or a doctor, and I was really dreading the future. So that was the progression.
I always drew houses. I mean, as far back as I guess I could hold a pencil, I just drew houses. And when I was probably in kindergarten, we did a little school skit where we had to sing rhymes or songs about what we wanted to do. And I thought I wanted to be a house builder. So they said, you want to be a carpenter. And I'm kind of glad I didn't go into that direction because that field is much more business oriented, and it's very much more about the bottom line than what we do. But I'd say it's, houses in particular have been an obsession since birth, and I'm sure there's something Freudian about it.
Kathy Springhorn.
Tom, you mentioned that almost anything can be rebuilt today. It was built 200, 150 years ago, whatever. But it would be so much more expensive. Why is that? With the modern tools and technology and transportation of materials and spectacular materials that are light and moldable, and what?
I guess, you know, if you look at receipts from houses built at the time this building was built, like I remember when I was a student at Columbia working under Bob Stern, I had to do a research project on a house by McKim Mead & White in Southampton. And what was amazing was how cheap things were that they built. And it wasn't just cheap because it was 1906 when the house was built. If you looked at what people were paid who did that kind of thing relative to the people who could afford to build them, there was an enormous gap. I think that gap is much closer now. Obviously, a carpenter doesn't make, or a really good fine woodworker who does furniture or moldings like these, doesn't make what someone who has $500 million makes or something like that. But it's still closer than it was, and so it is still proportionally more expensive for that kind of thing. And but I think that gap may be growing again. But there's only a certain amount of automation. You can, you know, I guess the answer, there are machines. Now, they didn't have them. You know, they're circular saws where you had to saw by hand, but it's still expensive. You know, the things that are only done by machine look that way. You can get only so far before you have to, someone who with a real chisel or sandpaper has to take over and make it look like this. So there is a lot of advancement in that kind of thing, but it's still... The people who can do it are few and far between, and it's expensive.
But even if you walk through some of the, not ghetto, but essentially, I mean, you know, the original sort of Third Avenue, extreme east, extreme west, side streets, tenement houses, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, back then, well, if you look at them, a lot of that's pressed tin, which came off of a stamper. So people,
there
I think...
wasn't attention to detail in the most modest...
Yeah, but again, that's because I think, first of all, I think people couldn't conceive of a house without a cornice. It just wasn't in their mind. The modernism hadn't happened. To us, a building with no moldings is sort of, you've seen it, you expect it. Back then, a house wasn't a house unless it had a pediment or something like that, or maybe columns in the front. So you had that in combination with the fact that there were people, bricklayers, you know, from Italy, fresh off the boat, who could do the stuff well and do it for almost, you know, for relatively nothing. I think those things have all changed, our perception and the cost.
Okay, we'll have one final question back there.
Well, it is. It was tough. When I started, it was a while ago, $6.50 an hour. I think my first year in 1982, I made $26,000 or something like that, or you know, something like that. It is hard. It's a constant worry for us. A, we need to be competitive. B, we have to balance the books. This recession has been, as people in the office can tell you, brutal. We all took salary cuts. We didn't pay bonuses. I think it's been rough for people, and it's something that literally keeps me up at night. I don't know if people in the audience who work for us believe that, but it's been tough.
It keeps them up at night.
I hope they're impassioned by it. I was. It made me kept me going through. I don't know about you.
I made $18,000 when I got out.
Yeah, I think it was 16. I don't think it was 26. It was not very much money.
That sounds kind of high.
More than half of my take-home pay went to the rent alone. And so I had $400 a month to make it through the...
But, you know, this profession, I hope this doesn't sound wrong, but you're working to... I mean, I always thought I would have my own firm, and it was worth paying the price, you know, while young, because everyone understood that was the system. That you start off, maybe you can't have a lot of, you know, extra money to spend when you're just starting out, but most people I know, and this recession has changed that, but probably, because a lot of people have left the profession. But for me personally, I just never thought about it. I did feel a privilege to work in the office of a very famous person, because everyone was competing for those jobs that paid no money. It was just a very exciting place to be. I mean, Bob Stern's office was an amazing place to be as a young person. Yeah. Around so many talented people, you're learning from everybody around you. You could take other jobs that paid more, but then the people around you might not be as stimulating. You might be doing work that just isn't your cup of tea.
Yeah, I was approached on a regular basis by headhunters for jobs in California, all over the place, and never for not just 20% more, sometimes 2.5 times what I was making, and just stayed where I was.
So,
actually, I just have two last questions.
Sure.
I first wanted to thank you for this brilliant presentation and discussion. One thing is, we didn't really touch upon issues of sustainability and green architecture, you know, creating these palatial structures.
Well, I agree. I people look at some of these houses and they sort of angers them that people have that much money they can, burn, put in a bonfire and burn this money when they build a house. So the reality is, and I sound like a trickle-down theorist, but everything you see there represents wages to somebody. I mean, in some of those big houses, and there are bigger ones, all that is money spent that keeps people employed, and it's just true from bricklayers all the way up, and there are hundreds of people on some of them who are employed for years. So the problem I have with them is what you bring up, is the environmental impact, because the amount of timber and wood and steel and fuel and heating oil that goes into them is really, I have trouble with, it worries me. And happily, almost all of our clients now, across income levels and political beliefs, are asking for green things. And John and I and many people in the office are LEED accredited now. Most of the houses have geothermal. Many of the houses have geothermal heating and cooling systems. We're using the right kind of paints, a lot of reclaimed materials. But even with that, it just barely scratches the surface, even with all that stuff I just described, of what the impact of these houses is. And that is the problem with what we do. That is the one thing I really have trouble with.
One thing I've never heard mentioned in terms of sustainability either is, how sustainable is it to build, a throwaway house? None of our houses is a throwaway house. And I think you have to respect that difference.
Yeah.
And the last thing is, how did you find the process of producing the book?
It was fun. It was a lot of work. I thought it was fun.
You did all the work.
It was interesting. The process was interesting because we worked with our agent, Jill Cohen, who is, if anybody wants to do a book, she is fantastic. And she came to us and first spent an hour with me saying why we couldn't publish a book because no one would ever buy it, et cetera, et cetera. And then she looked at the work and said, well, maybe we can do something. And it was interesting. She took a bunch of our photographs and came back with a proposal on what a book might look like. And she did it in a way that I just never seen our work before. Yeah, it happened to be all of our ceilings, all of our floors, all of our moldings, all kind of lined up. And you suddenly see yourself in a way you hadn't before. And the whole process was that way. It really made you go back and look at things and think about things differently. And the foreword by Robert Stern is interesting because we sort of felt the pressure in looking at this of where we should go, or I did. Look at this stuff. This is fine, but where are we in this? What's next? And Bob Stern's intro says, it's sort of a challenge. These guys have done okay. Where are they heading? When are they going to show us what they're really all about? So it was a very introspective and self-challenging process. And it was long, but it was fun.
It's also very well designed graphically. It's just amazing.
Thanks.
So as somebody who works for an architecture magazine where we're always trying to come up with a better solution to the design as well as the writing.
Said it's about Too much information, you mean?
That's what Wendy, that's what you were asking.
Yeah. Do we reveal too much of the magic? I'm not sure.
That's actually what's good about Joel's watercolors. He sort of touched on before. He does these sort of almost done things, these impressionistic paintings, and what's great about them is he knows what he wants to do with the house in his mind, but the client looks at this incomplete drawing, and they're finishing it in their mind, and they're happy because they have this idea. They don't know what Joel's really going to do. And, you know, you're right. With that model, you don't have that kind of luxury.
And, it's black and white.
And the truth is, we did do a lot of redesign because of it, but I don't know. Mm. Maybe it's another bad thing about it all.
It's an important point.
Yeah.
Also, animations, for example, don't really show. I mean, there's a spatial deformation that occurs.
There is, and actually, we just showed a client a model like that, and we purposely made it blurry. And so there's this model, and it's not quite in focus, and they're like, ah.
Did you really?
Yeah, we did. We did. And they loved it, and it was like, whew. You know? Before they know it'll all be done, it'll be too late. Oh, yeah.
Always.
That's part of the whole sustainability thing. I mean, that was what people did before.
Being a good architect.
Yeah.
And their LEED certification.
And all that stuff, yeah.
Well, it's just common sense.
Much of your photographs, that was sort of a leading question, and much of your photographs showed that, which was great. I have one question. On the Louvre pool house, do those go up and down?
No, they're fixed. They're about 10 inches deep, about that thick, and they just stay there.
You had a question?
We love small houses, and no project is too small. If anybody out there wants to build a house, if it's interesting, it's worth doing. John did a renovation on a house in New Jersey designed by Bailey Scott, who was an English arts and crafts architect, an amazing architect. There's a new book out on him, and we renovated two bathrooms in the kids' area of the house. It was just an amazing building by someone important. The local architects for that project were McKim, Mead, and White. And so it was an honor for us to do the bathroom renovation. So small houses are great, because you start them and they finish. I didn't show you one house that for one of our clients that we started in 1989 and we completed in 1995. So some of them can go on for years, and the small house, the small project is extremely satisfying.
Because at the end of the day, if you look at a very large house versus a small house, just by its very nature, you're using a much smaller footprint.
Exactly.
Yeah, one of the biggest things about LEED is build small. I mean, these houses would never qualify for LEED certification because once you get beyond 2,200 square feet, the points, it's all a point system, you start losing points right away. So small is green.
Okay, on that note, I would like to thank Tom Kligerman, Joel Barkley, John Eich in the audience, and all of you, Monticelli Press, and all of you from the New York Public Library who've made this evening possible. So thank you.
Thank you, Suzanne. Thank you.
Okay. Careful what you say, you're mic'd.